From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Something From Out There by August Derleth. There's a tendency on the part of the vast majority of people not only to take one another for granted, but to take all the aspects of their existence in the same manner. I sometimes think we are all too prone to accept as immutable law the scientific order of things, and not ready enough to challenge that order. Yet scientific laws are being altered and broken daily. New concepts come to the fore and take the place of the old, and they in turn are replaced by yet new theories based on seemingly equally irrefutable facts. But in actuality, many only recently discovered facts have their beginnings in time before man's recording. And it was certainly in such a distant past that so-called Malvern mystery had its origin. To some extent, it is still a mystery, for no one can satisfactorily explain what was found at Heiderstahl, not where it came from, nor how it came to be there in the first place. My own involvement in the mystery dated only to the night the Linwold constable, John Slade, roused me from sleep by pounding on the door of my combined office and home, and on my raising a window to call down, told me he had brought Jeffrey Malvern to see Dr. William Curry. "Found him out of his head," offered Slade in brief explanation. I dressed, went downstairs, and helped Slade bring the young man into my office, where he managed to sit down without collapsing, though he seemed ever on the verge of falling together. There he huddled, hands covering his face, shuddering and trembling, as if from the effects of a profound shock. I glanced at Slade, who stood fingering the rough stubble on his chin, and my eyes apparently asked the question that was on my tongue, for Slade shook his head helplessly and shrugged. So it was obvious that he had come upon Jeffrey in this condition and brought him directly to my office. I went over to Jeffrey and put my hand gently but firmly on his shoulder. He groaned, but in a moment his hand slid away from his face and he looked up. I was unable to keep from betraying my surprise. I could hardly believe that this drawn, chalk-pale, mud-splattered face, with black, unrecognizing eyes, yet lit with a burning, intense, haunted light, could be the face of Lord Malvern's son. Though there was not the slightest sign of recognition, the expression on his face, the intentness of his eyes now that they had become accustomed to the light, were evidence that he looked at someone or something he saw in his mind's eye, for his face began to work, his lips twisting and trembling, his fingers clenched. "What happened, Jeffrey?" I asked persuasively. At the sound of my voice, he doubled up once more, huddling in the chair, burying his distraught face in his hands, and made a kind of whimpering moaning sounds, as of a man in deadly terror, one of the most unpleasant sounds a medical man can hear. It was then, when he opened his hands wider than before, that the stone dropped from one of them and fell to the floor. Jeffrey did not appear to have noticed his loss, so I stooped and retrieved it. It was a queer, oddly shaped stone in the form of a five-pointed star, suggesting manufacture, and yet its appearance gave the lie to that suggestion. Nevertheless, it was in part at least a product of human hands, for a bone inscription, now partly encrusted over, but one I felt confident could be read. Indeed, I could make out three letters of what appeared to be a signature following the inscription: A.V. Period V. The age of the stone was indeterminable, but the inscription being Latin, its general aspect and its incrustations, which suggested that the stone had been in the sea, indicated that it was at least several centuries old. But the most curious aspect of the stone and that first contact with it was this. I had no sooner taken it up than I was conscious of a strange sense of power, a kind of benign strength that seemed to flow through me as a medium from some other place. This was a sensation I was destined never to be without, as long as the stone was on my person. Moreover, there was in addition as noticeable a sense of urgent direction, as if there was something connected with the stone that most vitally needed to be done. It seemed to me now, writing in retrospect, that it was this, more than Malvern's condition, which impelled me to probe into the mystery, and so perhaps save Linwold and the surrounding countryside from the horror which might have broken loose upon them. At the moment, however, I was too disturbed to heed these strong impressions. I held the stone before Geoffrey's eyes, raising his head by his tousled dark hair, and forcing him to look at it. "Where did you get this, Geoffrey?" I asked. "The stone," he murmured. For a moment his eyes were clear of the haunting horror that filled them, but he gave no sign of having heard my question. Then he began to sway a little, back and forth, muttering and murmuring brokenly to himself, and groaning as if in physical agony. Clearly nothing could be done save to give him a sedative and get him to bed. This I did, sending Slade to take him in my car to Lord Malvern's gaunt old home up the seacoast. Then I telephoned Lord Malvern to explain that Geoffrey had been found wandering on the streets in a dazed condition, saying that I had given him a sedative and recommending that he be put to bed at once. I promised to be up in the morning and took a look at him. Lord Malvern was unusually abrupt, but this I interpret as prompted by suspicion that his son had been up to mischief, for relations were strained between father and son, owing to Geoffrey's not infrequent escapades. It was not until the following day that I learned Geoffrey Malvern's movements in outline. He had set out from home alone the previous morning for a long walk over the lowlands near the seashore. In a meandering way, he had made for the ruined priory near his father's estate, which he had reached shortly after noon. At about 4 in the afternoon, he had stopped off at a tavern near the priory along the coast road and eaten a light lunch. Subsequently, he had paused briefly at the small cottage where Malvern's former gardener now lived. The young man had seemed quite natural. Both the tavern keeper and the ex-gardener testified that Geoffrey had joked quite heartily before continuing on his way. He had been returning to the priory before 5 o'clock, and several Linwold motorists had seen him reading in the shade of a yew grove near the ruins during the course of the hours between 5 and dusk. At or near dusk, Jeremy Cotton, a schoolmaster, had passed the priory on foot, and catching sight of Geoffrey, had cut off the coast road and into the prior grounds to talk to him. Geoffrey had been at this time busy poking about the ruins. When Cotton came up, he had evidently just come upon a queer sort of stone, which he had shown to the schoolmaster. Cotton's description of it, and his recital of their attempt to decipher its inscription, convinced me that the stone was identical with the one now in my possession. Cotton remembered that Geoffrey had been intensely curious about the star-shaped stone. He had been struck by the time by what he now thoughtfully termed an undue fascination. Asked about the book Geoffrey had been carrying, Cotton identified it as James' Cathedrals of England, and added that Geoffrey had told him he intended to visit the ruined Cathedral of Hightstall, which loomed just over the horizon, not far from the priory. These facts I managed to establish. Thereafter followed a blank interval, and then shortly after midnight occurred Geoffrey's entrance into Linwold in the condition in which Slade had found him. Something had happened in that interval between dusk and midnight to temporarily unbalance Geoffrey Malvern. The mystery intrigued me more than anything in my previous experience, and I was moreover impelled to solve it. I knew now by a power beyond my control, though I had not anticipated at the time, that Geoffrey Malvern might recover and be able to tell his own story, confirming such discoveries were made. Far from having any light thrown on the mystery in my visit to Malvern by the sea that morning, I was more mystified than ever, not so much by Geoffrey's condition, which had changed very little, but rather because of Lord Malvern's attitude. He asked me to say nothing of the affair to anyone, and in the course of his conversation with me, he dropped several hints that seemed to link Geoffrey's inexplicable madness with certain of the young man's Oxford activities. However, he did not seem to want the mystery investigated at all, and yet in his reference to the Oxford episodes as scandalous, Lord Malvern provided the second of the clues, which was to solve the puzzle. The first was the Starstone itself. But this I did not then know. But I began to wonder that evening whether there might not be some connection between some affair at Oxford and the mutterings of Malvern in delirium. Perhaps even between the five-pointed stone and the Oxford scandals. I remembered distinctly that several disgraceful occurrences had led to the sending down of four young men from Oxford, and only Geoffrey's influence had saved him from a like fate. So that evening, as I turned to the stone and cleaned away some of the incrustations so that I could decipher the inscription on it, fortunately the most important part of the inscriptions could still be read, though they required study, and even the fact that all the key words were present did not make my task much lighter. Such words and letters as had been rubbed completely away were few, and could easily be supplied. The inscription, when I had translated it, was enigmatic and vague. It read, "The five-pointed star being the key, with this key I imprison you in the name of him who created all things, spawn of elder evil, accursed in the sight of God, follower of mad Cthulhu, who dared return from ever damned Riley, I imprison you. May none ever effect your freedom. Augustine Bishop." The inscription appeared to be that of Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, famed among churchmen. This was the first intimation of fact I had in regard to the stone's actual age. The translation strengthened the connection in my mind between the stone and Geoffrey's derangement. And did the stone not refer to dark things by inference, at least in its inscription? There had been dark things done at Oxford, according to guarded accounts which had been made public. I began to believe, then, that the key to the mystery might possibly lie in the Oxford activities, or, if not the key, at least some tenable explanation that might help to discover the key. Why not, I thought, ask down one or two of the boys who had been dismissed from Oxford, and question them frankly about the affair which had brought them to disgrace. Accordingly, I dispatched a wire to Soames Hemery, whose address I found on a letter he had sent to the Times, anent the affair which had resulted in his being sent down from college. I suggested that Hemery bring along one or two of the other young men implicated in the scandal, if possible, and explained that Geoffrey's health and well-being lay in the balance. Hemery and Duncan Vernon, both friends of Geoffrey, arrived early next morning. Both seemed to be energetic and enthusiastic young men, though with a certain air restraint about them, both were anxious to be of all assistance possible. Their questions were curiously insistent once they knew Geoffrey's condition. Above all, what had Geoffrey said? "Nothing coherent," I answered promptly, and yet I could not help reflecting that he had spoken distinctly enough if one but had the keys to his subject. He had said several times, "Something from out there." I repeated this and mentioned the Starstone Geoffrey had been carrying. Vernon's eyes were far away, and there was a slight if troubled smile on his lips. "You saw the stone, doctor?" he asked presently. "What became of it?" "I went to the cabinet where I put the five-pointed Starstone and brought it, together with the inscription and my translation, to Vernon. Hemery, too, came crowding close, and the two of them, unable to conceal a mounting excitement, handled the stone wonderingly." "He did find it, then," Vernon murmured. "Pried it off something, by the look of it." and called it out," added Hemery. "This translation is excellent, Doctor," said Vernon. "I'm afraid you have some knowledge I don't have," I admitted. At this point, our discussion was interrupted by Slade, who came in hurriedly and said without preamble, "Old Crampton's been found dead, and they want you to examine his body." Crampton was a solitary fisherman who lived in a hut on the far side of Lynnwold. I assumed instantly that his death was a natural one, since he had been an old man for as long as I could remember. "What seems to have taken him off?" I asked conversationally. "Nobody knows. He was found in the cave those boys discovered under the old priory." Hemery and Vernon leaned forward, suddenly interested. I, too, was surprised at mention of the priory and at the introduction of a hitherto unknown cave beneath it. "One thing at a time, John," I said. "What boys?" "The three who got lost yesterday, Doctor." "I'm afraid I know nothing about them," I admitted. "Suppose you just tell us." "Henry Copp's two boys and Gibber Cloyes Albert, they were," said Slade, and launched into a story, which was simple enough. On the afternoon of the previous day, the three small boys had gone up to the ruins of the priory and failed to come back. Dusk fell and night came down, and still the boys did not return. A group of older boys set out to look for them and found them at last, safe on the seashore far beyond Lynnwold, and still farther from the priory, dazed and frightened, and with no idea how they had got there. Questions put to them had brought forth a queer story. They had gone to the ruins, where they had found a cave and passageway leading beneath, and had gone down to explore. They had crept along the cave until they had come upon a queer bundle in the darkness. They had felt around this, it being too dark to see anything, and had pulled a button off what seemed to be a coat or cloak. Then their hands had come into contact with a face, and they had got terribly frightened and had run. They thought they were lost, and for a long time wandered around in a perfect maze of caves, in some of which there was water, lots of it, until finally they had come out on the seashore, with no idea where they were until the exploring party had come upon them. That was well after midnight. Had they seen anything at the priory? Yes, they had. Just at dusk, but there was no describing it. "Like something from the animal park in London," said one of the boys. The button the boys had found was identified as an old brass button belonging to a coat well known as a property of Crampton. He was accordingly sent for, but could not be found. It came out finally that he had not been seen for the last few days, not since the evening of Geoffrey's strange attack. The button, coupled with the disappearance of the fisherman and the story of the curious bundle with a face the boys felt, caused a search for his body. It had been found in the priory cave when the tide was low, but in a strange, incomprehensible condition. As medical examiner, I was needed at the undertaker's shop. The suggested connection with Geoffrey's experience was too patent to ignore. I wasted no time asking further questions, but inviting my guest to accompany me, went along with Slade to view Crampton's body, which was indeed in a remarkable condition. Cold, almost to iciness, and as rigid, he might well have been frozen if this had not been so utterly impossible. As it was, the cause of death could be set down to whatever it was had crushed Crampton, for he was crushed, fully as much as if the priory had collapsed on him, his bones splintered and his flesh horribly mangled. It was the sight of Crampton's body which impelled Geoffrey's young friends to forego further retinence. I had felt that they were in possession of information I did not have, but I realized also that both were reluctant to speak. Sight of Crampton, however, had an ominously depressing effect on both of my companions. It was not until I had signed the certificate and left the undertaker's shop that they broke their silence. "I'm afraid that somehow we've gotten into something too dangerous to drop," said Hemery. "It isn't only Geoffrey who's in danger. There's not much to be done for him. I might as well tell you, Dr. Curry, if Geoffrey hadn't had hold of that star stone, he'd have been found like that fellow back there." "Go on," I said quietly. "I'm beginning to see that I was right in suspecting that this thing had its origins in your dark doings at Oxford." Neither denied it. Vernon admitted that their expulsion had been on justifiable grounds. And what were the doings? Old magic, worse than that, sorcery. They had practiced it, not really seriously, of course, but being sent down had put a more uncompromising aspect on the affair. "But what exactly did you do?" I asked. Vernon took up the story. "The whole business had an accidental beginning. Jeff shouldn't have gone in search of the stone alone. Perhaps it was because of our group he believed least. If he had more faith, he'd have known what he was likely to find if he tried to get at the secret of the Star Stone. It was by accident that we stumbled on a strange chapter of occult lore that would have been much better hidden. We were students of occult literature, and we had often come upon curious hints and suggestions of unnameable horrors, not precisely the kind of thing you run across in black mass jargon. And there were always strange names allied to such hints and references to the older gods, the ancient ones, and certain other purporting to be mad genii of evil who inhabited outer space before the world was born, and who descended to ravage Earth and were vanquished by the elder gods and banished to various parts of the cosmos. One of them to the bottom of the sea, where its accursed spawn is reputed to live deep in caverns in a lost sea kingdom variously called Rylai, Araya, or Reich. Of course, these references had no meaning for us. They were tantalizing, certainly with their very real suggestion of outer horrors, and in their curious parallelism to similar legends in the ancient lore of primitive peoples in all parts of the globe. But at length, Hemery stumbled on a set of books that told us things hidden for centuries. One by reputedly mad Arab, another by a German doctor, and finally the Confessions of Clithonus. A monk was likewise supposed somewhat deranged. At the same time, another of us found disturbing parallels in the fiction of certain British and American writers, suggesting that they too were aware of these strange mythology. Clithonus made direct mention of Heidstall, that is, the old cathedral, and told the story of Augustine. Yes, the St. Augustine Bishop of Hippo, who visited Heidstall, where Clithonus was. Clithonus had found on the seacoast a five-pointed stone, emblem of the power of the elder gods, and feared by the ancient ones and their minions. There are in the confessions, quote, disquieting hints of sea passages, unmentionable chambers and horrors beneath the sea, off the coast from Heidstall, and an opening on the coast somewhere along here. Then it's possible, I put in, that the passages in which those three boys who were lost yesterday are the same ones that the monk had reference to? Hemery nodded and went on with the story Vernon had begun. Clithonus writes of furtive treks down into the passages and of faint, horribly suggestive sounds from far below the surface of the sea. The displacement or removal of the stone Clithonus found seems to have left an opening for something out of the depths, away from a lost sea kingdom, or some place, let us just say, in the sea. At that point, Clithonus became frightened and took his fright to Augustine. It was the bishop who caused the thing, by the power of the five-pointed star stone, to be imprisoned in a stone casket far beneath the cellars of the priory near the cathedral. In an old letter, Augustine writes that the monk was mad, that he, Augustine, had banished him to Rome, and it is true that the confessions were originally published in Rome. But of the thing that came, Augustine says nothing, save for one cryptic line written to his pope. "Something from out there returned to these shores, and I have attended to it. There is nothing more." I drew the inference that the young men intended I should. "Then you think that something like the thing mentioned by Clithonus and Augustine killed Crampton, frightened Geoffrey Malvern, and was seen by the three boys lost in the passage?" Both nodded without hesitation. "There are strange stories in certain of those old books of the need these evil beings have of the life force drawn from human beings, the need for sacrifice of at least three living men to gain sufficient power to enable them to resume once again their former nefarious activities. One man hereabouts is dead. So far, there would not seem to have been more. The old legends all describe the victims as icy, frozen, and crushed, as Crampton was found. I'm afraid, Doctor, that the thing is even now lurking about the Priory in search of other victims. Crampton vanished on the night Jeff unwittingly liberated by removing the stone. It is left for us to send this thing back, if we can, back to the sunken kingdom from which it came. And the sooner we reach the Priory, the better, added Vernon. Yes, it's dusky now. The thing isn't likely to walk by light. Not yet. We shall need to take the stone. I had listened to this fantastic tale with a medical man's known skepticism, but there was a quiet persuasiveness about both Vernon and Hemery which carried its own conviction. Moreover, it could not be gainsaid that, had they intended a hoax, either could have concocted a far more credible tale. The story, in fact, was so preposterous as to just possibly be true, and it did fit such facts as were available to any disinterested observer. Even if but part of their tale were true, there was certainly something lethal at the Priory, and some attempt must be made to get at it. A faint silvery sickle of moon shone low in the afterglow when the three of us emerged from the house. I carried the star stone in my own pocket, one hand closed over its rough outlines, the inscription pressed against my palm. The evening was quiet, save for a faint wind off to sea. Apart from a casual remark about the mildness of the evening by Hemery and my own reply, there was no conversation. We walked to the outskirts of Lynnwold and were just about to shortcut across fields when I saw a figure running down the road toward us. I recognized him as Jasper Wayne, a retired farmer who lived near the Priory. Wayne came on us at a recklessly headlong speed, shouting and crying out to us, for he had seen us also. He came up presently to where we waited, but it took a few moments before he had calmed down sufficiently to speak coherently, and then the story he told was garbled. But it was no less alarming, for it supplemented damnably the tale I had listened to so dubiously only a short time ago. Wayne had been outside just at sundown, sweeping the countryside through a pair of field glasses. Happening to look towards the Priory, his eyes was caught by a shadowy movement. He had fixed his glasses on the ruins, just as his man, Herbert Green, who had been coming down the coast road with the horses, approached the Priory. As Green came abreast of the ruins, the shadow reappeared, took on substance, and seemed to roll awkwardly with some speed toward the road. The horses leaped forward, but not quickly enough to prevent the shadowy thing from throwing itself upon Green. For a few moments Green had been obscured, the horses dragging both him and the attacking shadow along the road in a cloud of dust. Then the thing rolled away, vanishing once again in the darkness, shrouding the ruins. The horses had dragged Green to the farm, but Green was oddly dead, icy cold, crushed horribly. "Where is he?" I asked. "Over on the veranda at my place, covered with a blanket. The horses got away, and I was just coming in for you. But he's dead. He don't need a doctor." "Well, go on," I said. "You keep on to Lynnwold for the undertaker. If we're not at your place when you get back, we'll have gone on to the Priory." Wayne started away again through the deepening twilight. "That makes two," said Hemery quietly, but his voice betrayed that he was deeply upset. We found Herbert Green's body at the farmhouse of Jasper Wayne. The marks showing where the body had been dragged away from the traces of the horses was still in evidence. I drew back the blanket, and from that examination I turned away in badly shaken state, reflected in my companions, for Green's was an exact repetition of Crampton's death. The same iciness, the same rigidity, the same crushed pulp. One such case had been enough to disturb me. A second was more than enough to fill me with terror and horror, not only because of what had happened, but because of what might yet take place in the light of the story Hemery and Vernon had told. Yet it was certain that if any solution were to be found, it lay within our power to seek and find it. There was nothing to be gained here, at the mutilated body of the second victim, to fall to the thing at the Priory. there was everything to be gained by proceeding without further delay to the priory itself, and prevent, if possible, any further outrage. The shadows were deepening around the ruins as we approached the priory. There was neither sound nor movement among the ruins. For what, after all, were we searching? What manner of thing? I put my question in a whisper to Vernon. "I've no more idea than you," he replied. "Something horrible, beyond description, or else it would never have driven Jeff mad. But if the thing's here, it will feel the power emanating from the stone." We waited in motionless silence. The night's voices had diminished to the sound of the resurgent waves of the nearby sea and the faraway cries of a side-coasting nightjar. For a long few minutes the scene held. Then there rose a new sound, fraught with suggestive terror, a lumbering, scraping sound accompanied by a terrible slavering. The sounds came from below the level at which we sat, from that level where presumably the legendary stone casket had been hidden. "Thank God we have the stone," murmured Vernon. Abruptly, an indescribable shape rose up among the ruins, giving forth a low undulation that seemed to roll up from deep within its misshapen hulk. It hesitated for but a moment, then rolled clumsily out into the lowland surrounding the ruins. Then it gathered speed as it moved forward.
"Give me the stone," asked Vernon. I surrendered it without hesitation. Vernon shouted and ran toward the thing, Henry and myself close behind him. But the entity from the ruins had apparently not seen us. It moved steadily toward the cathedral at a speed which forced us to exert ourselves to the utmost to keep up with it. Even so, it vanished into the ruined church before we could catch up to it. Once at the cathedral's roofless walls, Vernon called a halt. "It would not do for us to separate," he warned, lest the thing caught Hemery and myself alone and increase its own power by killing one of us, separated from the strength of the stone, which might then be powerless against it. Accordingly, the three of us entered the shadowed corridors of the cathedral together in search of our quarry. We crept silently through the ruins and back again, and then, becoming bolder, went forward with less care. But the thing was not in evidence. It had altered its course somewhere. Could it have doubled back to Wayne's house? I wondered apprehensively. After half an hour, my companions were despondent and spoke of returning either to the ruins of the priory or to Linwold. It was then that a shocking greenish hulk rose from the floor of the corridor before us and came directly toward us. At once Vernon faced it with a stone. The thing paused, but only for a moment, then a tentacle lashed forth and struck at Hemery. But Vernon sprang forward, bearing the stone as a sheath, and the thing in the corridor fell back, whistling weirdly. Out of the darkness before us shone a trio of cruel, malignant eyes, and the opening which served as its mouth gaped yawningly below. At the same moment, its body began to glow with an eerie sea-green light. Then once more the thing came at us. What happened after that remains like a nightmare of mad and fantastic images in my memory. The battle with the monster from outside seemed endless, but eventually it lumbered awkwardly away from Hiddesdall Cathedral and made for the priory. There it fought anew, fought a long time before it vanished into the depths of an underground passage. I suppose that at the end we were no longer human in our battle with the inhuman monster, fighting it back inch by inch, forcing its retreat until at last it crouched in hiding in the very gasket from which it had been liberated, when Jeffrey Malvern, as we learned later, had so ill-advisedly pried the star stone off the lid. How long the battle lasted, I could not say, but it was dawn when the three of us returned from the seacoast exhausted. The casket, sealed once more by the stone, lay in the ocean's depth, and already the events of the night seemed like a tenuous and incredible nightmare, as unreal as the amorphous thing which had so briefly returned to its ancient life in the priory ruins. But as to whence it came, in truth, no one could tell, nor could anyone say by what laws it had existed for so many centuries, to fatten and grow again in a time far beyond its own, to bring its horrors into a distant future. And what if someone in years to come, another searcher, takes up the stone once more and looses the thing from outside anew. Who knows? In other corners of this earth, there may be others biding their time.